It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
A Republican finally did what many could not, unseat Democratic State Senator Jim Mathias. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Delegate and now State Senator-elect Mary Beth Carozza won with 53% of the vote over Mathias in District 8, and she was reportedly recruited by Republican Governor Larry Hogan to challenge the Democrat. Mathias has always been fending off challenges by a few percentage points in the state legislature. He was first elected to the House of Delegates in 2006 and won the Senate seat in 2010. Before that, he served as mayor of Ocean City. His defeat also marks another loss for Eastern Shore Democrats after Norm Conway, who was chair of the House of Delegates Appropriations Committee, lost his seat a number of years ago. We have the senator in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program. So how are you feeling after such a long time in public office?
So what are your feelings now that you will be out of public office for first time in, I guess, many, many years?
Well, I still have so many days to go.
That's true.
But no, look, I'm grateful to the folks that allow me the privilege. Just take a moment. When you look at the mayors, the colorful mayors of Ocean City, and when the stories and the lore, but most importantly, when you're out on that beach, one of my greatest gratifications was being on that beach with Butch Arvin. We'd ride out on that beach on Saturday or Sunday, and you'd see the families under a big beach umbrella. You hear the oldies on the radio. You'd see them reading a book and with a bucket and sand, and just building memories are going to last a lifetime. And then you kind of go forward from that to where George Washington stood. You know, I was afforded the privilege in 2011 to give the Washington speech and to stand where he stood, the father of our country, and to look at how our country has changed, but how much it has remained the same with our freedoms, protecting our freedoms. The men and women out in the field today, whether those fields or abroad or right here on the streets, you know, where we are keeping us safe. To be able to be a part of that, I thank every person that has found that confidence and trust in me. And I'm still here, as I said, you know, respectfully. Hi, friends, it's Jim, and I'm still here, and please reach out. But it's been fabulous. I can go full spectrum from our universities to the opportunities, the access to health care, to cancer patients. God bless my lovely wife. You know, she founded the Worcester branch of the American Cancer Society, and I pledged to her that I would carry on. Parity in treatments with, it was chemotherapy. That was IV versus oral. So easier, more quick, not easier, but more easier access, and all those kind of things. Health care, education, business, they're getting ready to launch another rocket down at Wallops. You know, these are the things, the best part of this job people afforded me is seeing tomorrow today. So we're looking forward to tomorrow now, perhaps in a different realm. But, you know, I feel good. The most important thing, the measure is the people have spoken. That's what all the things I just talked about, our armed services are out there protecting. That's what this whole process is about, is the people's voice. They've spoken, and I listen.
So, looking back here for a moment, what went wrong?
Well, I don't know, I think what went wrong. It was bigger than us this time. I mean, really, I haven't seen the final numbers, but let's be frank about it. That's why you and I get along so well. The area has continued to trend Republican. I do not perform my politics in a partisan way. I never have. I've been about the Eastern Shore. Everything we're about, that's who I am. President Trump has aroused the base. You know, you look in some of the down ballot races here in Worcester County. We didn't have a sheriff. A Democratic sheriff was not there. We didn't have a Democratic state's attorney. In a couple of the House races, they were uncontested. What did that mean? In some of these races, folks that were still registered as Democrats re-registered as Republicans. The base was further aroused, not only by the president, but honestly, the Kavanaugh hearings. People were incensed. People were coming up to me. Sometimes they thought perhaps I was a U.S. senator, but they knew quickly that, you know, I was a state senator, and I brought that respectfully to their attention. But they were incensed by the hearings and certain things that happened. It was a call to action. a month out. You know, Governor Hogan's numbers down here were 76. The Democratic candidate, Jealous, was 21. My opponent did everything that she could do in the party to put me and him together because a simple handshake, you know, they tried to portray me. Look, I wasn't able to be there with Governor O'Malley. He was my friend, the mayor of Baltimore, then the governor. I was the mayor of Ocean City. I had to stand alone from those races. I've always stood alone. But yet again, with all due respect, my opponent, the base was excited. My opponent and the strategist put me in a, I don't know if you got it, it was the three of us, you know, I sing that song Mustang Sally, and it was the three of us in a red Mustang, like, coming over the roads of the Eastern Shore, Ben Jealous, Martin O'Malley, and myself. And in some of these precincts, I haven't seen them all, Governor Hogan, and look, God bless him, you know, he got 80%. You know, he dwarfed the 76%. Some I hear he got 90%. A month ago, at least, he went up on TV. I vote with the bad guys. You know, I'm the liberal from Baltimore. Oh, my gosh. With all due respect, that's so far from true. And then the flood of the negativity. With all due respect, making it easier to get heroin in your community than ice cream. Saying I voted for all 38 or 39 of O'Malley's taxes. It's bunk. It's bunk. And I call them on it. Not in a terse way, but it's bunk. You know, all I can say to you is when you have the convergence of all those issues that I just talked about, you know, and still, we have at least two more absentee counts. I'm happy to tell you, and I'll give you right now my thoughts about it. Respectfully, we did win early voting by a couple hundred. I think it was maybe 1.9%. As of the moment, we're up in absentees. So it appears to me simply when you take and look at the earlier the vote is cast, if you look at it in a context of negative campaigning, it looks like the less exposed our voter is to that negativity, the better that they are, you know, kind of more objectively informed. So, and again, it's about getting out the base. So nothing went wrong. I think, quite honestly, what has remained the standard in the most modest of senses is Jim. I've been the standard. Our farmers have called me on the phone, grain and poultry, you know, our families, our educators. I said, I mentioned to you earlier before we went on air, I got a personal Facebook message from Spain this morning from a young lady who I've worked very closely with regards to suicide prevention. And the tears, I went to a restaurant the other night I haven't really been in ever before, believe it or not. There is such one. And I thought, uh-oh, we're going to go in here. There were eight tables there. Honestly, folks from all the tables came over. Some teared up. So, look, I'm not tearful. I'm joyful. We're getting ready to celebrate the holidays. I have a lot to be thankful for. But, you know, the behavior, I have to say, my son was cursed. He was talked to tersely, and I won't say what poll he was at all day. He's a medical school student, PhD. I won't get into it, you know. But he was talked to tersely and cursed twice. My daughter was pregnant 6 months, was talked despicably to twice at the polls. And your dad ain't no good no more. I mean, with all due respect, I mean, is that what our politics are? I just ask everybody to do a little soul searching. I don't think any of us want that. Any of us. When we raise our children, when we profess who we are and what we are as a people, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure that's not our standard. We can't allow that to become our standard.
Let me ask you, so one of the things that obviously in the campaign was that Mary Beth Carosa, the Republican who won, tied you to the top leadership, Democratic leadership, and the state legislature. How do you think that approach to her campaigning will play with those people who are in the top leadership?
Well, respectfully, not well. Not well. But I will say to you that I just did an hour-long interview yesterday with Governing Magazine. They're getting ready to do a full feature in January on President Miller, who's the longest-serving state president, state Senate president in the United States of America. And despite all that, I could tell you one thing. He's from Maryland. So I think at some point, you know, it'll all become objective. It'll become a part of history, but not well at all. You know, the same way, how can in one part of the state And look, I'm not, this is very unabashed. You know, Governor Hogan, who tells me he loves me, we went through all that before. In one part of the state, he's up there saying how he's bipartisan and putting his arms around the president and the speaker. But yet down here, they're creating commercials and vilifying me for talking to the same guys. But you asked me a simple question. How's it going to play? Not well. Not well. You know, the Strive for Five failed. It failed.
Right, that would have created the ability to uphold the veto, an
opportunity that would have allowed the veto to stand. It failed, but guess what else they lost? They lost the key to moderation. When I served with the other 32 Democratic senators in the caucus, I stood up and I was able to moderate the position many, many, many times, and I was able to broker. I was a bridge between Governor Hogan and President Miller and Speaker Bush. And I'm not making any bones about it. I was. And we collaboratively made a difference for what we needed here on the shore. Now that challenge goes to my opponent. We'll see. I was over at Veterans Day. I've always gotten along exceedingly well with all of our military veterans, police, fire, paramedics, and all. And I was talking to the Marines. The gentleman knows who he was. And he very boastfully, you know, I said, "Yeah, you know, I didn't vote for you." And I said, "Well, that's what you fought for. And that's what it's all about." I said, "You know, I think you might have made a mistake." "No, I don't think I did." I said, "Well, check in a year from now." And that's the test, with all due respect. That's the test. A year from now, 2 years from now, when the former President Bell from UMES called, said that the millions of dollars weren't in there to do all the studies and the design work for the pharmacy building down there, and they were already up against the wall by losing the PA certification there. And I got the call at 10 of 10, and I went in before I went to the floor and knocked on the president's door, and I told him what the problem was that night at 7:38 o'clock. He came and fetched me out of a dinner and said, "I got you your money." That's called relationships, and that is what is the most important accomplishment I've achieved, and that's what, let's check in a year from now or 2 years from now and see how well it works out. My opponent's success is our success. My opponent's ideology may differ from ours, but our needs are the same. What we need here for education, higher education, curtailing the cost, rural health care delivery, our transportation, so many of the things that we need every day, and that takes collaboration.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that if she goes knocking on the speaker's door or the Senate president's door, that is going to be opened?
No, you'd have to ask them. I think, you know, in public service, as a longstanding leader, yes. Yes. I think there'll be some frank conversation, as there should be. But leaders don't shut doors in people's faces. You can portray the leadership that I have earned the respect from and share the respect with across the full spectrum of party and political ideology, and they never shut doors in my face. Have we had our moments? Sure, I've been tersely spoken to by the Senate president, and I've been sometimes ignored by the speaker and others. But you know what? That goes with the game. You watch any game, you see the coaches on the sideline. You know, sometimes the clipboards go up in the air and the earphones come off. But guess what? It's called sportsmanship. You don't shut doors in people's faces. Now, I don't think the doors will be shut.
Well, let me ask you this, because I've been here about 15 years or so, and one of the things that struck me is that many of the prominent Democratic representatives in Annapolis have been disappearing. I think about Norm Conway, who was in the delegate and chair of the Appropriations Committee. Now, Muir obviously disappeared. It looks as if...
But we haven't disappeared.
Well, you're getting a good job there.
Our public acclaim right. For that office is, we were outnumbered at the moment, but go ahead.
But nonetheless, I mean, do you think that the shore, from a legislative point of view, is perhaps losing as much representation or as much clout, for instance, as it perhaps would have had it had, for instance, yourself and say, Conway, have been reelected?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I mean, respectfully, I just said it minutes ago.
Yeah.
We were the bridges, and we were moderates. you know, look, there's dissension even in our own party with the progressive arm of the party. And you know, they were, I say patient, you know, they were patient. Sometimes they thought I was Republican light. I think there was a letter to the editor in the Daily Times this Sunday. But no, yeah, I think that, yes, our voices now are less present. Our moderation is not there at the table at the moment. I was given the opportunity to be completely blunt. Why wouldn't I be? To change my party. I was wooed. I'm not doing it. You know, because I don't vote party. Look, my grandmother was a riveter in the war and worked in a candy factory in Baltimore City. We lived in a row house. I said, Mom, I'm going down to vote, register to vote tomorrow. How should I vote? Only one damn way, Jimmy, Democrat, you simple. And you know, I can't tell you that every race ever that I've participated in, I voted democratically. But I could tell you one thing. I was sticking with my principles, you know, and my principles are humane. They're about people. And I could tell you, we have brokered the peace across party lines.
Let me ask you this. At least at this point, it seems to me, and you tell me if you think this is true, that the Eastern Shore and certainly rural areas have benefited from the fact that Larry Hogan, who obviously sees that as his political base, certainly, that we've benefited from the fact that there is this Republican who's sitting in the governor's office who actually wants to sees his base as being rural as opposed to the big cities. Do you think that?
Obviously,
they won't last forever, right?
No. But look, I get along well. I don't like the behavior that I just experienced, but I get along well, you know, with the governor. Some people say, how can you even say that? But no, look, being attuned to our more rural base and needs, I applaud the governor. At the same point in time, let's be honest, ECI. He turned a deaf ear to ECI for a long time.
Eastern Correctional Institution.
Okay, that's right. In the staffing issues there. A deaf ear, folks, if you missed me the first time. Okay? And you go and get those families here, okay, and the risk that they endured down there, and the folks that still had a number of viable years left in their career, they retired out because they were fearful of their safety. Now, here's a governor who is lifted up the Eastern Shore and did nothing for them down there. So look, it kind of cuts both ways. When I came to the call 2 years ago, and I came to the call and I stood with those families down there, I didn't put my finger respectfully in the governor's eye. I didn't provoke him. I'm not provoking him today. He's been there for our needs, but some he's missed. And that's a serious one down there.
Let me ask you this. Your career, you started out, I think, in Ocean City. You were ultimately mayor. What do you remember best about being mayor of Ocean City?
Well, we won the All-America City Award. I mean, that was fabulous. You know, my late wife, she was the coordinator. She was the assistant to the city manager. But we went and competed with 100 cities across the United States of America. And where we won was in Atlanta, Georgia, the birthplace of Dr. Martin Luther King. And we took the performing arts choir from Stephen Decatur High School. And personally, I took them to Dr. King's birthplace and to his church and to the eternal flame to show what difference one person can make. When they said Ocean City won, 10 cities won across out of 100. The roof, I think we're still paying to fix the roof there. We went through the roof. Fabulous. When we went to Katrina, we went out under armed guard and fed children that hadn't eaten, which we didn't even realize, in a handful of days. And when that young man came through for the third time and somebody in the line said, young man, didn't you just come through? He said, yes, sir, but I haven't eaten in 2 or 3 days, and I don't want that to happen again. When we went to Ground Zero, there's a piece of steel entombed in the firefighters' memorial that was given to me from a governor, from the mayor there, from Mayor Giuliani. We were there 5 days after the attack. Clay Stamp. We went back up. He sat in the EOC and down at Pier 92, I believe. I know the original EOC collapsed. We were there 5 days after the attack. It was like turning off the volume, watching our people come together, learning from Fish Powell. God bless his soul. Harry Kelly. I was the first person in the world that ever had a Guinness World Book pinball marathon. I was 24 years old, weighed 135 pounds, smoking cigarettes. And who do you think cut the ribbon? Mayor Harry Kelly. Little did I ever know that I would follow in his footsteps. And you know, I say thanks to the people of Ocean City, my family. I can go a full spectrum. When we fought the good fight, if you recall, the wooden boardwalk ended right there at Division Street in front of Tony's. And it became concrete all the way up to the ramp down at in front of Trimper's there at South Division Street. And some of my colleagues that are still serving today wanted to make that a brick paver promenade. And I said, no, that's a boardwalk, man. That's a boardwalk. That's what we're all about there. That's what people come there, you know. And they said, no. I don't know if you remember. And I was able to convince a reporter in the Daily Times to cause them to do a poll. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Overwhelmingly, they said a wooden boardwalk. When I stood up there and we dedicated that wooden boardwalk, we put that archway there, a sense of place. Lieutenant Governor Kathleen Kennedy Towns and I have the picture with the fireworks going off. We continued to keep the legacy of who we are alive, and on and on and on. Serving in the fire company, when we would be first on the scene, whether it was in the high rises or a biplane accident that went down, and working out there and being at the lead, all the way across the spectrum. But most importantly, as I said earlier, that young lady today from Spain. Or when I just went, I'm a bell ringer chair for Salvation Army. I came in, you know, the road, no good deed goes unpunished. I thought I had plenty of time on my hands this morning. I walked out and spilled coffee over myself on the floor. When I got there, and I called them to know I was coming, people came over and took my hand and just said, thanks. That is the greatest gift God can give you, is helping people. And in any capacity, I just came over here. A man's car was overheating, and I pulled up to help him. I mean, but that's who I am. That's who I hope that I've been able to inspire. And I know you may have some more questions, but the greatest thing I hope that I've been able to achieve with everybody's support was inspiring the next generation.
Let me ask you this. And, you know, you move obviously onto the House of Delegates and then ultimately to the State Senate. What was the most difficult thing, do you think, about being a legislator like that? And as opposed, for instance, a mayor. Mayor's got an executive position, got responsible for all these things, right? What do you think was the most difficult thing for you to overcome or deal with as a state legislator?
Well, the numbers, you know, 1 of 71 in the House. I had modestly had achieved notoriety and some prominence as a mayor. But then in order to be effective to get a bill passed, you had to find that majority in committee, and then you had to find it again on the floor. And then the same thing, you know, 1 of 24 over in the Senate, and figuring out collaboratively how to build that alliance. So for me, you know, look, we had our tensions on the council. I was a city council member. We had our tensions on the council. We had our tension as the mayor. Look, these aren't wallflowers. Folks in elected office aren't wallflowers. Everybody has their thoughts and their ideas. Finding that balance, and it was tough to do. You know, I didn't always have this full shock of white hair. And my daughter sent me a picture from the campaign grounds in 1988 when I was managing Jimmy Hall's campaign. I looked like Rod Stewart. But you know, along comes, you know, maturity. Along comes experience. So the most challenging thing for me was finding that, building those relationships, and that and knowing that that was that collaborative effort that led to achievement for your people.
Let me ask you this. So you've been obviously lived a long time on the shore. You and certainly represented it. How do you see the area having changed over that long span of time that you've been a public official?
Well, certainly far more developed. And I will say that the opportunities do exist here. I think that, I'm a business guy. I've been in business over 40 years. We have, in some circles, we've extended our our seasons here in tourism and the like. Certainly, I think we've been able to lift the respect, I don't mean like that word, but been able to make sure we brought the consciousness forward for agriculture, for poultry, for our commercial watermen, for the legacy of the shore. But, you know, clearly, I think that with Chairman Conway and our delegation, and modestly myself, we've been able to bring capital projects here. You know, Route 113, the dualization of Route 113.
Right.
They started that project plus or minus in like 1970. And they had like, I don't know, what it would have been seven or so different legs of it. And they had accomplished like one or two, and it sat dormant until when Chairman Conway and I were together in the House during the Great Recession, when every other road project in Maryland was killed. We were able to get that one done. Only two were passed. We were able to get that one done and then came behind it when they finally passed the federal transportation budget. I called the chairman on the phone. I read it in the paper in the morning. I said, we got to go see Governor O'Malley. And we were there. We put it right in front of him. He said, look, I don't know if you all are going to get this, but you're the first ones that have come here. So raising the consciousness of the needs of the shore. But we're thriving. I tried to get Governor Hogan down at the Wallops Island. I got the budget secretary, David Brinkley, down there. We did that $40 million tax credit for Northrop Grumman. They have a bigger presence here now. These are the emerging opportunities of tomorrow. So the things that we've been able to accomplish and achieve and the consciousness that we've raised, again, I said to you and during the debate, the greatest experience, the most gratifying experience I've had in my life was going to my grandmother's home after church on Sunday and having Sunday dinner there. By 4 o'clock, the whole family was there, 20, 25 of us, and we talked about where we were going, what we were doing, who was going to have a baby, who wasn't doing well. You know, the brain drain you hear on the shore, what I have been committed to and remain committed to, vocational training and the like and burgeoning opportunity here, is to make sure that 4 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon here around the family table in the kitchen on the Eastern Shore, that our families are together, that they're not FaceTiming in from Florida or Chicago or California. Everybody has an itch they want to scratch, and they want to go to New York or they want to go out to the West Coast. I understand that. But and I urge you to, you know, it's, you know, scratch that itch. But what I want to make certain here is the opportunities here, our greatest asset here on the shore are our families, and I worked hard and will continue to work hard to make sure that there are opportunities here for their families to grow strong.
In the few minutes we have left, what do you make of the political atmosphere that we seem to be living in at this moment? Mm-hmm. And obviously, we just had a recent election in which Democrats have taken over the House. But what do you make of this atmosphere that we now seem to be living in, which seems, I think, dramatically different than perhaps in the past? And where did it start? I mean, how did this happen? You've been in politics a long time.
My gosh, I don't know how it happened, but all due respect, let's be blunt, you know. If I ever talked to people like that, I certainly wouldn't be here. I would have been run out of town. I mean, I've been run out of town. I watched the presidential campaign as it was escalating in 2016. And I said, well, you know, this has nothing to do with Canada. This is no way this can be. No way this can be. Now, other Democratic operatives told me the minute they saw the president come down that escalator, they knew that that was the person, you know. I think some people feel like they were disenfranchised for a long period of time, and he appears to be speaking to them, and they have a voice, and they have an emotional fervor about themselves. I've tried to avoid all that. You know, the funny thing, I brought Miss USA to Maryland 2 years in a row and didn't even realize when it came to my attention as the mayor that the president now was the owner of Miss USA.
Right.
I wrote him a letter when he got elected as president. I said, we've enjoyed success. I look forward to continued success. I don't know where it is or how it is, but I can tell you, my part is to not participate in it. We've kept it on the high road. We're going to keep it on the high road. I hope, as I said before, that those folks that spoke to Trevor that way or Lauren that way, they know who they are. They know why they spoke to him that way. I hope that we can calm their soul. and understand that the soul and their commitment is our country and the decency that we found it. You see those portraits and pictures of our legislators sitting around the fire back in the 1700s and 1800s with those long pipes and whatever was in those cups. You know, I know they had dissension back in those days, but they found common ground to move forward. I don't know how this has happened. I hope that it is a moment in time and that we can be more about being Marylanders and about being Americans, about being Eastern Shore folks, and because we all got great, great hearts and a fabulous family to make sure that we remain committed to for our future.
Real quick, will you think about running again for any office?
I mean, sure. Maybe. I mean, the machinations aren't here.
Right. Now, it's too early.
Right. No, clearly. Look, I thrive on public service, and I love it. As I mentioned to you earlier, I mean, I'm still picking up kind of like the pieces. But yes, I love people, and I have been able to learn right firsthand how to be successful and effective in building alliances. If that's in public service, great. If that's in the private sector for folks that need that representation and that voice, that'll work too. But absolutely, and I want to say I thank you, sure. And I thank all those who've been part of it and those that have had questions. I hope that I can answer those questions for you one day in another race, maybe.
I think we got a maybe there. I appreciate you taking the time to stop by. We've been talking with State Senator Jim Mathias, who will be leaving office in January, but a long career, political career, particularly here on the Eastern Shore. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Absolutely. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy holidays to all.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. We are entering the holiday season, but there are many who will not be celebrating in the comfort of their own home. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Homelessness does not take off for the holiday. Last year, around 469,000 adults found themselves homeless nationwide. Meanwhile, an estimated 184,000 people and families found themselves without permanent shelter. It amounted to nearly 58,000 family households. Here on the Eastern Shore, various charitable organizations are gearing up for the cold temperatures of winter. And in our studio this morning is Jim Barnes. He's with the Christian Shelter here in Salisbury. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
So what is the situation now with in terms of the homeless and what you're seeing, as particularly as we head into this cold winter season?
Well, now, overall, homelessness has steadily increasing. Our numbers increase, and also the nature of the homeless population has changed over the years. Now we see a lot fewer single men and a lot more families, and particularly children. But this time of year, as we come into the holidays, is our slowest time of year in the months of November and December. Because there's around the holidays, there's much more sympathy out there in the general public for homeless folks, and the weather's getting cold and nasty, and so there are more resources available through churches and various philanthropic organizations out there. There's more resources for the homeless available right at this time of year. And also, another interesting thing that happens around the holidays is families of folks who are homeless tend to soften their hearts during the holidays, and they will invite their wayward relatives to come and stay with them for maybe a week or two over the holidays. Of course, then after Christmas, their welcome gets worn out and they're back out there again. So our numbers tend to go down, particularly in families, around this time of year.
So how many people come to your shelter that you have any estimate about?
Well, right now, we've got 48 homeless individuals staying in the shelter. 15 of those are men, and we have 12 women right now, and we have 21 children. That's the largest part of our population right now, which is sad at this time of year, because it's not, it's not nice to not have a home around Christmas time.
Does that have a psychological impact on people? I mean, the holidays, and as opposed to any other time of year when they're homeless? I mean, is that a reminder?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think it tends to lower some of the barriers a little around holidays, and people who might otherwise be a little more sober and serious about getting their lives turned around, getting jobs and all, will drift off the path and get into partying and some of that kind of thing. And for children, it generally expresses itself in a little more out of control behavior during the holidays. It's a tough time for them because they remember things at home and a Christmas tree and presents and stuff like that. And here they are in a shelter, a kind of drab shelter. And it's the reaction in them is to kind of get a little more rammy.
This time. Yeah. So why do you think that you're seeing this increase in families? I mean, do you have any sense about that at all? What do they tell you?
Well, my standard theory on that, because I can find no other better, well, some practical explanation, cost of housing just keeps going up. And rental housing, especially in this area, with a lot of retirees and the student population growing, why a lot of rental housing gets taken up by people who do have reasonable means. And so the price of that rental housing tends to steadily go up. People with low incomes, whose incomes are not going up, begin to get screened out of the picture, and particularly families and single parent families with children that are struggling right on the margin anyway. And those factors are still very much present, and the numbers seem to be growing.
I mean, we're sitting in an economy that, at least from statistically speaking, we're somewhere between 3% and 4% unemployment. Which is almost virtually full employment under standard economic analysis. But yet, the people seem to still be struggling. Do you have any sense about why that is? I mean, is it just simply that
there are more jobs available? No, I think it's mostly on the cost of housing side where the crunch comes, because there are jobs available.
Are they just so low service jobs? I mean, low wage service
jobs?
Well,
for many of our folks, the folks that we see at the shelter, yeah, that's true, because they have relatively limited education and fairly limited job experience, and so they're confined to lower echelon. Although even the chicken plants have been raising salaries, and they've gotten salaries up to a pretty decent place. But I think it's the cost of housing is the big factor. You get a little more income, but the rental goes up faster than the income.
So how do you, at this shelter, how do you then accommodate families? And because obviously you still have single men there. Do you have, like, women with the families? Is that the predominant characteristic?
That's the predominant picture, is single mothers with families. We've increased the number of family spaces in the shelter. We've had to do some construction changes in the shelter. And now we have 13 rooms that are devoted to families. And these are rooms that usually will contain 4 to 6 beds and have a bath. They have their own bathroom. Shower facility is connected right there in the room. So the families they're not too bad. They're relatively comfortable situation. And like I say, we've increased the number of those. We've converted storage space into family rooms. So we've got 13 of those family rooms now.
But that just seems like a small number of places compared to what I'm sure must be the demand.
Yeah.
Are there like a lot of others? Or, I mean, what, I mean?
Well, actually, over the past, so far this year, why we've been having to turn a lot of people away just because there's no room, and we're coming into the time of year that's the hardest thing about my job, is especially when the weather's bad and you have a mother with several small children come to the door in the evening and say, you know, can we stay here? We have no place to go. And everything's full. And you got to look at them and, geez, sometimes they got melting snow dripping off their heads and soaking wet and miserable looking. And you have to look at them and say, I'm sorry, but I've got no beds, no rooms. It's all full.
Is there any way to help them, to send them to somewhere else?
Yeah. Almost for us. Now, we can't send them to a motel because we don't have the funds to do that. But we can, social services, particularly when there's children involved, social services, they do have some funding available to put people in motels if that's the only resource. Or we can make referrals to there's another shelter in town, and there are a couple of shelters outside of town, one down in Ocean City and one in Pocomoke, that we can refer folks to. Mm-hmm. But generally, there are emergency resources available. If there's no place for them to go and the weather's bad out there, there's children involved, why the social services will get them a place.
You were looking at something there.
I was looking at the numbers. So far in this year, we've housed a total of 760 people, and we've turned away about 600. So we've turned away almost as many people as we've housed just because there's not enough room.
So if these people can't find some option with, say, social services or some of the other shelters or whatever, where does that leave? What kind of experience is it like then?
Alternatives that they face, and this is true, I think, probably for many people. Live in a car or a van, double up, and this is more frequently the case, is just find a relative or a friend out there who has a place and double up with them and sleep on the floor or on couches. And when you're talking about children, this is a difficult situation, but those are the kinds of alternatives that people will take if there just isn't shelter space.
So we were talking a bit about the impact, particularly on children. I noticed something like, I think it's something like 292,000 of the homeless folks nationwide, I think it was last year, were children. And of those, 144,000 were actually under the age of 6. What kind of impact does that have on children, particularly emotionally and then behavior-wise?
I think the studies show that the impact is tremendous. Achievement in academic achievement in schools is lower for homeless kids. Family disruption and brokenness is increased with homeless kids. Less stable family settings and all, more behavioral problems, and ultimately further down the line, more involvement in criminal activity and more likely to be sentenced to prison eventually, to end up in jail or in difficulty with the law. So there's a lot of negative impacts on kids, who, especially at a fairly young age. And of course, the other impact that we see is the cyclical nature of the thing. If the kids grow up in homeless situations, they tend to be less stable when they get married. And particularly, a mother of starts having children in the lower income brackets, maybe at age 16, 17 years old. Well, her children are going to inherit a sense of instability and maybe some of the same behavioral patterns, seeking immediate gratification instead of long-term planning and that kind of thing, that leads to, as those kids grow up and they become 16 and they get married and they start having children. And it's much more likely that the children of homeless folks are going to end up being homeless themselves and their children homeless. And there's a multiplying effect that it's not just a single arithmetic multiple, it's a geometric multiple that goes on that says 5-10 years down the line, the homeless population is going to be increased by a fairly substantial amount.
So if people can't find shelter, particularly single men, but where do they go? Do they do bridges? What is that typical day like then for them?
That's hard to say. There are those, and it's more likely to be single men that are homeless more or less by lifestyle choice. Some of those lifestyle choices are not as easy to pinpoint, but for example, you get a guy who comes along and he comes out of a relatively unstable home himself, and the job alternatives for him, if he hasn't finished a high school education, are places like chicken factories, and that's hard work, and the pay isn't all that high, and in the chicken factories particularly, that kind of work, hard physical labor kind of things, doing a job as a roofer in the winter when you're out there in the cold. By the end of the week, you're tired and cold and miserable and aching all over, and your little paycheck is about $300 or something like that. At the end of the week, and the landlord's going to grab up most of that. And you turn around and you see your friend who doesn't work and hangs on the corner, and he can make $200-$300 in a couple of hours selling drugs or whatever on the corner. And you're making your little $300 once a week and breaking your back for it. Why, that could tend to discourage you, make you think twice about, well, maybe I don't want to work. Maybe I want to hang on the corner and get that easy money. So in those situations, well, those folk can make pretty good money. Even the guys that stand on the corners with the signs that say, help me, mm-hmm. I'm homeless, they can pull in $50 to $100 a day just collecting money out in the street. And that gives them enough money to rent a cheap motel room for the night. And, of course, in a motel room, they've got TV, and it's not too bad, and it's warm in there. But there are also, there are folks who are homeless by choice and won't settle down enough, won't even be able to stay in shelters very long. They'll get kicked out because of behavior patterns that are disruptive and create problems in the shelter. And those folk tend to live... many of them live outdoors in camps, and there are encampments of homeless folks around the city and in various places. They get rousted every once in a while. If they get pretty noisy or obnoxious out there, well, they'll get rousted and they'll move on to some other location.
Let me ask you this, because I would think that being homeless and that just sheer lack of certainly mental activity in terms of generally speaking, that you're just out there and you're certainly exposed to the elements, even whether it's the summer or the winter, that's got to have some kind of psychological numbing effect on someone. That if you spend 6 months or a year out there on the street, it's going to affect you mentally as well as physically in terms of how you relate to people and society in general. I mean, it sounds to me like it should have some effect in and of itself.
Well, maybe, but chances are that a lot of those people that are experiencing that kind of, and that's not a huge population, but that are living on the street, as it were, from hand to mouth. I don't know whether the chicken comes first or the egg comes first. Mm. Whether the lack of mental stimulation was there before they became homeless and then contributed to their homelessness, or whether it's a product of being homeless. I had a friend in New York City one time who came he was a graduate student in college, and as part of his coursework, he was doing research on homelessness. And so he chose to spend, I think, about a month on the street in New York City homeless. He came... We were running a shelter there, and he came in and left his belongings with us and said, I'm just going out there with no money, and one set of raggedy clothes, and I'm going to see, find out what it's like out there. And he came back to us at the end of his time, 2 or 3 weeks. He came back and said, and kind of talked with us a bit about his experience out there. And he said that food was no problem on the street. You can always get food. If need be, you just find the dumpsters behind a restaurant and dig stuff out of there. But mostly you can bum food back in the kitchen door of most restaurants. You can pick up enough food to survive on. Okay. And even camping out on the street, you can find places where the rain doesn't get on you, and you can curl up and sleep for a little bit. He said the biggest thing is fear. The worst thing about being out there on the street is fear. And of course, I suppose, because fear of somebody else who's in the same state you are coming along and beating you on the head or lighting your cardboard box on fire or who knows what. And that it's dangerous out there on the street, which is one of the things that we try to counteract in the shelter by creating an atmosphere where the fear is minimized, where it's, there's a sense of order and peacefulness and calm inside that shelter so that people can begin to relax a little bit and let down a little bit and begin to think a little bit about their own life. Where am I going and what is my life about anyway? Because while you're out there on the street, yeah, there's not much time to do any long-term planning or thinking about your life. It's mostly scrabbling just to get by for one more day.
So what role do things like alcohol and drug addiction play in all of this? I mean, that obviously is the stereotypical image that we certainly have of folks who wind up homeless. What kind of role does that play?
They're in the mix. They're very much in the mix. I would say probably between 30 and 40% of the folk who come into the shelter are involved with, in some way, with drugs or alcohol, and we monitor that very carefully, because that can be a very dangerous thing. But there was kind of a lull. Crack cocaine was the biggest thing, and drug thing, but more recently in the last couple of years, heroin is back in big force, and the over prescription of painkillers.
Yeah.
Oh boy, that's been a brutal thing. That gets people hooked, and then the cost of prescription drugs gets to be very, very high. To buy it in the drugstore, and they find that they can get the same or better pain relief for much less money by buying street drugs and getting into that. And that's, the street thing, and especially heroin, has increased markedly in the last couple of 3 years. And that is a problem. And in the shelter, we just can't allow drug use to go on with folks staying in the shelter, because it becomes a danger to everybody, and particularly children that are in that shelter. So we're very strict about that. And we do drug testing and alcohol testing in the shelter on a regular basis. And if somebody is using drugs, and particularly if they bring any of it into the shelter, why, that's it. They've got to go. We can't have that danger in there.
So if they have this problem, where can they go?
The rehab programs, hospital, PRMC has a whole unit for detoxification, and they refer people out to various drug rehab programs. What I like to refer people to is the long-term Christian rehab programs, the teen challenge type programs, because they're so very, very effective. And they really, if you complete one of those programs, your likelihood of going back into drugs again is a lot slimmer than doing a 28-day, behavioral modification kind of program. But there are resources for that.
So what do you think we should be doing as a society, particularly in a governmental level, that we're not doing for homelessness?
Well,
I mean, it's a policy, but I mean, I'll ask.
I believe legislation that supports and encourages the strengthening of families. We've tended to get kind of casual government-wise and say, well, it takes a village to raise a child and the government can do it. And so we create programs to take the place of parents and a home, and even create legislation that discourages parents from staying together and keeping homes intact. And that's, my sense is that we need to reverse that. And then the other tendency of government has been to discourage and try to stamp out religion. But anything that has to do with God, look out, man, that's no good. And keep it out of the schools and keep it out of the public discourse. And you can penalize somebody that turns out to be pray much, that kind of stuff. And that's, those are the two greatest resources that people who are struggling, low-income folks who are struggling and run into a real hard time in their lives, the two best resources they've got is, number one, faith in God, and number two, family, somebody to come alongside them and family and help hold things together. And as we eliminate those in terms of the way governments operate, the more we eliminate things like family and God, the more we create a society where somebody who's struggling doesn't have a solid thing to turn to, and they tend to fall apart. And in fact, a large percentage of people that we see at the shelter have mental health problems and bring with them bags full of very strong antipsychotic medications that just make it almost impossible for them to function, to get back to functioning steadily, seriously, reliably in job settings, in education, in homes. I don't see any quick, easy answers. The picture is a little bit grim and discouraging, at least for the immediate future, because we seem to be moving further and further in the direction of a society with no norms, fewer and fewer, no morality, no standards, no firm standards. Everything's just, you know, whatever you think is right, it's got to be right. And that creates a setting where there's a lot of instability, and you end up, and I think we're going to continue to see growing number of folks who are homeless.
I may have alluded to this, but why do you think that there is this sort of atomization, I guess, for lack of a better word, of the family? I mean, at one time, particularly certainly from the beginning of the founding of the country to certainly the 20th century, the extended family was the sort of safety net. You know, that you didn't, I mean, you needed programs, obviously, and for instance, when the immigrants came in the late 1800s, you had state agencies that had to deal with this. And obviously, yeah, in the 1930s, we had the feds. But we don't seem to have that extended sense of family anymore. We're all scattered out from, you know, my relatives in Kentucky and California and Florida. Yeah. And so, I mean, we're not centrally located, say, for instance, we once were, where, oh, okay, the guy down the road, you know, I know him or he's a relative. I mean, there seems to be this sort of breakup just from a social and economic standpoint. We just sort of divide it up.
Well, and a family is hard work. It's not an easy thing. it's relationships that are tough. And we've seemed to have given up on far hard work in our society. Anything that causes pain or causes hard work and stress, you want to avoid. Take pills or whatever, you knock down a couple of drinks, but let's not put ourselves in a situation where we may experience a little pain and we may have to struggle and work hard.
Do you think that our modern age, particularly in the 21st century, has been the social media and so on and so forth, in which we don't even see each other, we communicate. I mean, do you think that's? I mean, that has the impact.
Big factor. The fact that in order to be totally entertained these days, why it's all in your right in your living room. You've got all these wonderful sound systems and visual systems, and you don't even have to go out the door. I think communication, the art of communication, is a lost art nowadays because you get in these cell phones, a little thing you're carrying around in your hand that can do almost anything. And that tends to discourage development of relationships and the ability to communicate effectively with one another. Gee, you have one of these little phones, you just have a few code words and that's all you need to know. You don't need to know language anymore. So these are things that I think these are parts of our society that break down and isolate us. We live in much more isolation today than we ever used to. But that seems to be a natural product of progress. So we're progressing marvelously towards chaos.
You think there's anything we can do about that?
One by one. How you make choices and decisions and how a parent raises their kids to make choices and decisions. I think that's the level on which the change has to occur.
We've been speaking with Jim Barnes. He's with the Christian Shelter here in Salisbury, Maryland, and taking in the homeless. And, of course, we should remember them, particularly during these cold winter times, but also perhaps when it's not so cold as well. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you very much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.